This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Ezekiel. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 40, with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
In 1990, an incumbent judge in Oklahoma City, a man named Frank Ogden, won 91% of the vote over his challenger, Josh Evans. Though the judge won the election handily, he never served his term on the bench. And the reason? 3 months before the election, Judge Ogden died. It's amazing. 91% of Oklahoma City's electorate voted for a stiff, a dead man. And that shouldn't be a surprise, for that's been happening to us ever since the Garden of Eden. We could all vote for God to rule over mankind with truth and with mercy. Instead, we consistently vote for dead guys. We opt for humans who lack God's wisdom. And yet one day, God is going to reign over the earth that He created and over the affairs of men. And not merely from behind the scenes. No. God is going to take center stage. The Bible tells us that Jesus will return. He'll slay His enemies. He'll establish His throne in Israel, and He'll rule this planet for 1,000 years. Ezekiel has promised a new covenant. God made a threefold promise to His exiled people. He would regather them to the land. He would breathe spiritual life into their regenerate hearts. And He would reestablish a political kingdom to Israel that would reign globally for 1,000 years. God's promise to David that a son would never cease sitting on His throne and would rule the world will finally be realized, for Jesus will return to fulfill all God's promises to Israel. This final period of life on earth as we know it, the Scripture calls the Kingdom Age or the Millennial Kingdom. And it is the subject of Ezekiel's last 9 chapters. Looking ahead, chapters 47 and 48 lay out new boundaries and new topography for the land of Israel during this Kingdom Age. Chapters 44 to 46 describe a new worship for Israel during this time. And tonight, chapters 40 through 43 tell us about a new temple that will be built in Israel. We call it the Millennial Temple. But before we dive in, it might be helpful to give you just a brief overview of the Hebrew temple in its different forms over the different ages. You know, the Bible speaks of 5 different temples for God. That is, beside the New Testament temple or the spiritual temple we call the church. The first dwelling place on the earth for God was His tabernacle. You remember the glory of God filled a tent in the wilderness. God traveled with His people Israel through the desert. When Israel settled the land, Solomon built a more permanent, a more glorious temple. It stood for 370 years until it was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. And when the Jews returned from Babel 70 years later, their governor, Zerubbabel, he led them in building a second temple. Of course, it was a shack compared to Solomon's more glorious temple. So when Herod became king, in order to court favor with the Jews, he promised to expand this temple. This was the temple that was visited by Jesus. But it too was destroyed shortly thereafter in 70 AD by the Roman legion. And for the last 1,946 years, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the God-sanctioned plot where the temple was to stand, has been under Gentile control. Thus, any thought of the Jews rebuilding their holy temple has been absurd. That is, until June of 1967. That's when Israeli paratroopers took back the old city of Jerusalem. It was a marvelous, miraculous day. For the first time since 70 AD, Jews had regained military control of the Temple Mount. And of course, this area is also sacred to Islam. Two mosques also sit on top of the Temple Mount. And since 1967, Israel has managed to maintain a fragile truce by giving the Muslims religious control of the Temple Mount while they maintain military control, and that is the standoff that exists today. And yet, since 1967, there has been a growing movement in Israel to rebuild their sacred temple. You see, Judaism is a hollow religion without a temple and its altar, and it can only be built on God's ordained spot. Sacrifice and blood atonement is at the heart of Jewish religion. And without a temple, it's a missing part of their worship. Whenever we go to Israel, we always visit the Temple Institute. It's a group of Jews who are dedicated to this future temple. They've already built the instruments and implements and furniture needed for the temple. All they're waiting on is the actual temple to be built. And they are only one of many, many groups in Israel who are longing, who are working toward rebuilding a temple. To me, this is one of the most startling signs that we're in the last days, the prospects of a rebuilt temple. You see, we know from Scripture that two more temples are going to be built. Daniel 9 and Matthew chapter 24 both predict the rise of a world leader called the Antichrist. And he is going to desecrate the temple in Jerusalem. He is going to enter its courts, and he is going to claim to be God. It's a blasphemous act, but it assumes that a temple will be rebuilt. When this happens, it infuriates God. He pours out fierce judgments on the earth. A time of great tribulation begins, culminating with the Battle of Armageddon and Jesus' return to rule over this planet. And that's when the final temple, what we call the millennial temple, will be built by Messiah himself. Zechariah chapter 6, verses 12 and 13 predict, "Behold, the man whose name is the branch," a branch from the lineage of David, a messianic title, "from out of his place he shall branch out," that is Jesus, "and he shall build the temple of the Lord." Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord. "He shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule on his throne." And notice this, "so he shall be a priest on his throne." Now that's unusual. For in ancient Israel, there was a separation of church and state. Kings weren't allowed to be priests. Priests weren't allowed to be kings. That's why we know that this is a new temple yet to be built, with new protocols. Jesus will rebuild the temple on its ancient site. He'll set up the worship of this temple, and he will rule from his temple over Jerusalem and over the world. And this is the temple that Ezekiel sees in tonight's chapters. He begins his description in Ezekiel chapter 40. "In the 25th year of our captivity, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was captured." The year is 572 BC. The day is Nisan the 10th, which was an interesting date on the Hebrew calendar. It's the first day of the preparations for the Passover. Remember, this was the day when the priest would inspect the sacrifices that would be offered in the temple later that week, on the day of Passover. And this was the same day, remember, that Jesus presented himself to the nation when he rode the donkey down the mountain into the city of Jerusalem. He was presenting himself for inspection. We call it his triumphant entry. Amazingly, on the same day, 600 years earlier, Ezekiel was taken back to the future and given a vision of this future temple. He says, "On the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city." He's taken in a vision. What all occurred, we're not quite sure, but it was an experience with God. God took him. He's living in Babylon at the time, by the river Chebar. And all of a sudden, he gets caught up in this trance. He sees this vision. He's taken in this vision to a mountain, a high mountain there in the land of Israel. What mountain? We're not told. It could have been Mount Scopus, north of Jerusalem. Scopus looks down on the Temple Mount. But Ezekiel says that he sees what he calls something like the structure of a city. Perhaps he's trying to describe a modern city, what it would look like to a person in antiquity. God takes Ezekiel to Israel in a vision. Now, he took me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. Now, whenever we go to Israel, we always have a tour guide. You hope you get a good one. After you go a few times, you request a good one. Well, here Ezekiel gets a tour guide. And by the way, this is a good one. We'll find out later. He has measuring instruments in his hands. The standard rod was 12 feet long. The line of flax was like a tape. It was for longer measurements. This guide is going to take Ezekiel on a tour of this temple, and he's going to provide him exact measurements. Verse 4. And the man said to me, "Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears, and fix your mind on everything I show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see." Now, Ezekiel is about to be blown away. Remember, Ezekiel was a priest with no temple. That's like being a pilot with no plane or a lifeguard with no pool. And yet God chooses Ezekiel to show him a future temple. This has to infuse hope in his heart. It assures him that Israel will return to their land, that this temple will be rebuilt. This thrills this exiled priest. And yet God warns him not to get wrapped up in the thrill and in the chill and miss out on the details that he's to record. See, this is one of the problems with spiritual experiences. You know, at times the lessons that these experiences intend to teach get lost in the emotions they elicit. You know, when God reveals himself to us, sometimes we get so caught up in the thrill of it all that we forget what it was that he said. Hey, whenever God reveals himself to us, the goal is usually more than just a divine tickle. He's trying to communicate to us truth, principles for our lives. We need to enjoy God's presence, but never miss God's purpose. And that's what God tells Ezekiel: fix your mind on everything I show you, for you were brought here so that I might show them to you, declare to the house of Israel everything you see. What Ezekiel is about to see, he needs to declare. So he needs to pay attention to every detail. Verse 5. Now there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. In the man's hand was a measuring rod 6 cubits long, which being a cubit and a handbreadth, and he measured the width of the wall structure, 1 rod, and the height, 1 rod. Now, Ezekiel's rod measured 6 cubits. A cubit was a standard of measurement in the ancient world. It was determined by the distance between the king's elbow and his longest finger. That was a cubit. The problem was that everybody's cubit varied just a little. Ezekiel says that the cubit he's using is a cubit and a handbreadth. If that's a Hebrew cubit, which was 18 inches, and a handbreadth, which was the width of a man's hand, or 3 inches, then the Babylonian cubit was 21 inches. This was the standard length of the cubit in Babylon. That would make Ezekiel's measuring rod, which was 6 cubits, 10 and a half feet, or 6 inches longer than the height of a basketball goal. And here he measures the wall around the temple. Its height and its width is 1 rod. That is, it's 10.5 foot thick by 10.5 foot thick. Now, whenever we go to Jerusalem, I always take our group to the Wailing Wall. We usually go at night. To me, it's prettiest at night. It's the last remnant of Herod's temple. People consider it a sacred spot. In fact, worshipers all over the world often fax their prayers to the temple wall people and have those prayers inserted into the crevices of the wall, thinking God would be more inclined to hear and answer their prayers if they were prayed at the Wailing Wall. Once I was praying at the wall, and I'll never forget it, I'm there praying, and God spoke to me in one of those clear fashions. And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, "Sandy, I no longer dwell in temples made with stone. Today I dwell in believing hearts." Kind of put it in perspective for me. And you know, because of that truth, there are some folks who disagree with a literal interpretation of Ezekiel's vision. What does God care about another temple made with stones? And so they allegorize these verses. They apply these verses to the spiritual temple, the church. But that is not the clear reading of our text. Why is it God tells Ezekiel, make sure you pay attention to every dimension? Make sure you pay attention to what you see. There's more going on here than just spiritual allegory. I believe that when Jesus returns to earth and sets up his kingdom, a physical, literal temple will again serve a purpose. Again, if this is just allegory, why is Ezekiel shown such technicality and implored to go into such detail? In these verses, Ezekiel's tour guide gives him a verbal blueprint for a future temple yet to be built. Now, beginning in verse 6, we're going to read a while. Ezekiel is going to describe the three gates to this temple's outer court. The gate on the east, on the north, and on the south. And then there are three corresponding gates within the inner court. And as we read these verses, I want to throw up some drawings to help you envision what Ezekiel is describing. So as I read, you read with me, but you also keep one eye on the screen. Keep one eye on the screen, one eye on your Bible, and you'll get this just fine. Then he went to the gateway which faced east. And he went up its stairs and measured the threshold of the gateway, which was one rod wide, and the other threshold was one rod wide. Each gate chamber was one rod long and one rod wide. Between the gate chambers was a space of 5 cubits. And the threshold of the gateway by the vestibule of the inside gate was one rod. He also measured the vestibule of the inside gate, one rod. Then he measured the vestibule of the gateway, 8 cubits, and the gatepost, 2 cubits. The vestibule of the gate was on the inside. In the eastern gateway were 3 gate chambers on one side and 3 on the other. The 3 were all the same size. Also, the gateposts were of the same size on this side and on that side. He measured the width of the entrance to the gateway, 10 cubits, and the length of the gate, 13 cubits. There was a space in front of the gate chambers, 1 cubit on this side and 1 cubit on that side. The gate chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. Then he measured the gateway from the roof of one of the gate chambers to the roof of the other. The width was 25 cubits as door faces door. From the entrance to the gate, here's what's going on. There are 3 gates in the outer court. They correspond with 3 gates on the inner court. And from the entrance of the gate to its exit was 43 3/4 feet. In other words, these were long gates. These were oriental gates. These were gate systems. Where you didn't just, we think of a gate, we think of one swinging fence. But their gates were like systems of protection or systems of commerce. People would line the inside of the gates and various functions would go on in the city's gates. The gates leading into the temple were that kind of a construction. They were these long walkways. These gates, too, were very, very high. We're told that he measured the gateposts 60 cubits high. That's 105 feet. And the court all around the gateway extended to the gatepost. These gates were skyscrapers, the height of a 10-story building. He goes on, from the front of the entrance gate to the front of the vestibule of the inner gate was 50 cubits. In other words, there's an inner gate opposite the outer gate. There were beveled window frames in the gate chambers and in their intervening archways on the inside of the gateway all around. And likewise in the vestibules. There were windows all around on the inside, and on each gatepost were palm trees. In other words, this temple had some craftsmanship going on. It had some ornamentation going on. There were arches. There were beveled windows. There were engraved palm trees. Then he brought me into the outer court, and there were chambers and a pavement made all around the court. 30 chambers faced the pavement. The pavement was by the side of the gateways, corresponding to the length of the gateways. This was the lower pavement. Then he measured the width from the front of the lower gateway to the front of the inner court exterior, 100 cubits toward the east and the north. On the outer court was also a gateway facing north, and he measured its length and its width. Its gate chambers, 3 on this side and 3 on that side, its gateposts and its archways, had the same measurements as the first gate. Its length was 50 cubits and its width 25 cubits. Its windows and those of its archways and also its palm trees had the same measurements as the gateway facing east. It was ascended by 7 steps, and its archway was in front of it. A gate of the inner court was opposite the northern gateway, just as the eastern gateway. And he measured from gateway to gateway 100 cubits. And so you've got 3 gates on the outer court, then 3 gates on the inner court. After that, he brought me toward the south. And there are a gateway was facing south, and he measured its gateposts and archways according to these same measurements. So all 6 gates were of the same size, the 3 on the outer wall and the 3 on the inner court. Now, there were windows in it, and in its archways all around like those windows, its length was 50 cubits and its width 25 cubits. In other words, they were rectangular. These gateways were rectangular, 50 cubits long, 25 cubits wide. 7 steps led up to it, and its archways was in front of them, and it had palm trees on its gateposts, 1 on this side and 1 on that side. There was also a gateway on the inner court facing south, and he measured from gateway to gateway toward the south 100 cubits. Then he brought me to the inner court through the southern gateway. He measured the southern gateway according to these same measurements. Also, its gate chambers, its gate posts, and its archways were according to these same measurements. There were windows in it and in its archways all around. It was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits wide. Again, the gates were rectangular shaped. There were archways all around, 25 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. Its archways faced the outer court. Palm trees were on its gateposts, and going up to it were 8 steps. There were 7 steps leading up to the outer gates, but then there were 8 steps leading up to the inner gates. And he brought me into the inner court facing east. He measured the gateway according to these same measurements. Also, its gate chambers, its gateposts, and its archways were according to these same measurements, and there were windows in it and in its archways all around. It was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits wide. Its archways faced the outer court, and palm trees were on its gateposts on this side and on that side, and going up to it were 8 steps.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio. Sandy Adams teaches out of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. We are currently going through the book of Ezekiel, which is in the Old Testament. Ezekiel was one of the prophets in Israel, and much of the book deals with judgments on Israel and the surrounding nations for sinning and rebelling against God. As dark as this may seem, there was a purpose. It wasn't for nothing. God used exile help the Israelites examine their hearts He used Ezekiel to point the people back toward Jesus. I would bet that every single one of us has faced a dark season in life where visibility was at an all-time low. What did you do to clear the fog? You ask God for help? Do you realign your thought process to match God's promises? Are there any areas in your life where you're seeking God's justice? If you have questions about the message you just heard or any prayer requests, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. You can also find more information on our website, sandyadams.org. While you're there, you can listen to more teachings or you can download our mobile app to listen to these messages wherever you are. Join us again next time on Sandy Adams Radio.